From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is The Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, coming up, we've got the latest episode of Health on the Margins. That's Radio Catskill's feature podcast focusing on rural health issues, produced by Kimberly Izar. And tonight, Kimberly will be looking at the opioid crisis, specifically the opioid settlement funds. But first, we're going to wrap up last night's election, starting with reports from our partners in the New York Public News Network. In New York City, Zohran Mamdani won the race for New York City mayor, easily defeating former Governor Andrew Cuomo. John Campbell, the New York Public News Network, reports.
Mamdani is a 34-year-old Democratic socialist who will be New York City's youngest mayor in more than a century. His campaign energized young voters who turned out in droves to support his plans to enact universal child care and make city buses free. He thanked them in his victory speech.
Thank you to the next generation of New Yorkers who refuse to accept that the promise of a better future was a relic of the past.
Mamdani's win puts an end to Cuomo's political comeback attempt. The former governor was trying to return to elected office after he resigned amid scandal 4 years ago. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
Now, Mamdani convinced New York City voters to back his agenda, but next he faces Albany. How will he do there? Will he get the support of Capitol politicians? Those are the questions that Sam Mellons and Chris Bragg of New York Focus are asking. And I'll be asking them those questions myself on Monday night's Local Edition, so we'll be covering that story then. Be listening for that. Now, in other New York election news, while the Republican candidate got less than 10% of the vote in New York City's mayoral race, making it a big night for Democrats as well as the Working Families Party, that was not the case in the suburbs of New York City. Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman and almost all of his fellow Republicans won by large margins. Larry Levy is with the National Center of Suburban Studies at Hofstra University.
The X factor may be that the Nassau County Republican organization deserves its reputation as one of the strongest in the country. In a county, again, with enrollment numbers that favor the Democrats, Republicans pulled more of their people to the polls.
Levy says diverse suburban swing counties like Nassau can be bellwethers for national elections. Nassau voters elected two Democrats to the U.S. House of Representatives last year, and they enjoy higher voter registration than Republicans. Now, on to the back of the ballot in New York State. Voters across New York narrowly approved Proposition 1 on Tuesday, the ballot measure that amends the state constitution to retroactively allow ski trails and other development on the Adirondack Forest Preserve. Prop 1 was approved by about 46% of voters, while more than 12% left their ballots blank. For more on the measure that directly affects our listening area, here's North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell.
With the approval of Proposition 1, the New York State Constitution will be amended to allow development at Mount Van Hovenburg Olympic Sports Complex in Lake Placid. The state-run site is managed by the Olympic Regional Development Authority. Years ago, ORDA violated the state's constitution when it cut down trees on part of the property that's on State Forest Preserve. A majority of voters in every North Country county approved Prop 1. The ballot measure wasn't as well received downstate, where it was rejected by a majority of voters in most counties in the New York City area. Voters in Manhattan narrowly approved the measure by a 1% margin. Now that Prop 1 has been approved, ORDA's management and any future development at Mount Van Hovenburg will be legal. Voters have approved similar amendments to allow state management at Whiteface and Gore Mountains. The passage of Prop 1 also approves a new land deal for the Adirondacks. The DEC is now required to add 2,500 acres of land to the Forest Preserve as a way to make amends for ORDA's past violations. The DEC says it's unclear where that new Forest Preserve land will be or how the state will pay for it. In the Adirondacks, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
And thanks always to the New York Public News Network for those reports. We have just a quick update on one local race, perhaps the most visible race in Sullivan County last night, and that's a race for Sullivan County Sheriff. Incumbent Mike Schiff ran unopposed on the Republican and Conservative Party lines, but he received opposition from write-in candidate Tim Diamond. Now, while we don't know which candidates received write-in votes last night, preliminary results from the Sullivan County Board of Elections give us an idea of how many write-in votes there were in total. And those added up to nearly 34% of the overall vote. So that compares to Schiff's nearly 66%. Even if all of those write-in votes did go to Diamond, he would still be about 28% behind Schiff. Not only is that a big margin of victory for Schiff, it's an even bigger margin of victory than when he defeated Diamond in the Republican primary in June. In a social media post last night, Diamond said, quote, "Unfortunately, we came up short in the general election for sheriff. I respect the voters' choice, and I truly appreciate the nearly 5,000 voters who decided to write my name in on their ballot. I wish the best to the brave men and women of the sheriff's office." Now, Diamond went on to thank his team, and then he added, quote, "Win or lose, it's been a great learning experience, and our county will improve because of this." End quote from Tim Diamond. And that is it for election news. At least for tonight. Right now on the Local Edition, it's time for our monthly deep dive into rural health issues with the Health on the Margins podcast. So I'm handing things over to Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar.
Hey, it's Kimberly Izar. A note for our listeners, this episode discusses substance use and addiction and may be difficult to listen to. It's 1996. Nintendo 64 debuted its video games in America. Bill Clinton was reelected president of the United States. And the pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma released OxyContin. It's a powerful opioid prescribed to treat persistent and severe pain. And it's around this time that health experts said the opioid crisis began. After Purdue Pharma released OxyContin, it aggressively marketed to care providers. In just 4 years, its sales grew from $48 million in 1996 to almost $1.1 billion in 2000. In 1998, the company made this video and distributed 15,000 copies to physicians without FDA approval. They asked doctors to show it to patients.
Once you've found the right doctor and have told him or her about your pain, don't be afraid to take what they give you. Often, it will be an opioid medication. Some patients may be afraid of taking opioids because they're perceived as too strong or addictive. But that is far from actual fact. Less than 1% of patients taking opioids actually become addicted. And any drowsiness that might occur when you start to take the medication will soon wear off in most patients.
The marketing video is not only misleading, it's also not true. As many as 1 in 4 people receiving prescription opioids long-term in a primary care setting struggles with opioid addiction, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. Over the last 2 decades, the number of opioid-related overdoses has skyrocketed. More than 5,000 New Yorkers died from an opioid overdose in 2023, according to State Health Department data. And by 2021, lawmakers, families, and health advocates had enough. New York State enacted legislation to create a dedicated opioid settlement fund to address the opioid crisis. Opioid settlement funds is money that states secured from lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies for their role in fueling the opioid epidemic. And for New York, they've secured over $2.5 billion in opioid settlement dollars to date that the state says they'll distribute over the next 18 years. So, where is the money?
There's a bunch of money, I think, sitting unspent. And I'm worried about that being stolen, to be honest, by the state for other purposes.
From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Health on the Margins, a series that looks at the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania's fragile healthcare deserts. Over the past few decades, the number of healthcare providers has declined. Community hospitals have closed, and access to what is available is getting further and further from home. Health on the Margins digs into how we got here and where our rural region may head next. This is episode 2 of our series, and today we're looking at opioid settlement funds. I'm Kimberly Izar. So if you haven't already listened to the first episode on the state of the opioid crisis, I really recommend that you start there. It gives some important information for this episode. You can find Health on the Margins on our website at wjffradio.org. When I was reporting on that episode, a lot of people were both excited and worried about opioid settlement funds because, well, it's a lot of money.
Starting today, And for the next month, I will be traveling our state, spreading the good news that we are delivering as much as $1.5 billion to New Yorkers.
That's Attorney General Letitia James back in 2021 in North Country after her office filed the state's most extensive opioid settlement lawsuit against manufacturers, distributors, and the Sackler family who own Purdue Pharma.
And it's not over. As you know, we've got a trial in Suffolk County with two remaining defendants. So the trial is continuing, but also we are continuing having settlement discussions with those two defendants, and hopefully we'll bring you some more money.
And she was right. More money kept coming to New York State under the promise that those funds would repair the damage of the opioid crisis in the communities most harmed. But does the money actually go where it should? Well, in New York, it's not so simple to find out. Here's the thing. If you wanted to quickly find something simple, let's say a list of all the treatment centers in the Catskills that's received money, well, you'll have to do a lot of digging. Once New York State's Office of Addiction Services and Supports, or OASIS, distributes to local counties, they have minimal oversight on how it's spent. There's an annual report that counties need to submit to the state, but there's really no standard format. For instance, Sullivan County's report lists all contracts listed with exact amounts, but Orange County's report, for example, is much less detailed. I recently spoke with Rob Kent, who is a substance use expert, to help me understand how money exactly moves in New York. He was the former general counsel for the Biden administration's White House of National Drug Control Policy, and before that, he was general counsel for OASIS. Kent is one of several people Radio Catskill spoke to who criticized New York State for being too slow to move the money and keep track of where it's going. Rob, what kind of oversight does OASIS have exactly?
Not much. I mean, the state legislature has started to look at whether they should have not necessarily oversight, but more information coming from the local governments. There were some articles written in Newsday in Long Island about how the two counties in Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk, had spent very little of their money. And a lot was sitting in the bank earning interest, which the government was using likely for other purposes. So OASIS, the state can't tell the counties how to spend their money, which is a real problem, by the way, because that's what leads you into following the same bad path that the tobacco settlements followed, which is most of the money was not used for you know, its intended purpose. And so, yeah, local governments are supposed to report information. I think they're going to be asked to report more information. But in terms of OASIS saying you shouldn't be spending the money on this or that, they don't have that authority in the law.
Radio Catskill reached out to our New York listening area's health departments in Sullivan, Orange, and Ulster counties to learn how they spent their funds. Sullivan and Ulster counties shared their 2024 spending totals, but Orange County did not respond to our questions before this episode aired. Even with Sullivan and Ulster counties, it took some back and forth to get the information. And in Sullivan County, treatment programs for people with substance use issues still made up the smallest share of spending in 2024 compared to law enforcement and prevention efforts. In October, New York earned $35 million in interest from opioid settlement dollars just sitting.
There is money sitting unspent, and no one can tell me the need is not there. It absolutely is there.
Are there any time-bound restrictions with these funds at the state level or at the county level?
No. I mean, that basically at the state level, money comes into the state. It has to be appropriated in the budget process, which it has been. And if it's not spent in that fiscal year, usually what they do is reappropriate it for future use. And that's where I noticed, I mean, when I looked at budget bills in the last number of years, how much money was being reappropriated, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
The disparities depending on where you live are astronomical. Even though they're only about an hour apart, Sullivan County prescribed opioids at nearly three times the rate of Rockland County in 2023. Sullivan County has the third highest per capita opioid overdose deaths in New York State.
It seems to have been lost on folks that the government's really the fiduciary of this money. It wasn't their money. They got it because people's kids and loved ones died from opioids. And there doesn't seem to be a real big outreach, especially to the families who've been impacted.
Tracy Gardner, executive director of the National Black Harm Reduction Network, agrees. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke to Gardner, who said communities most impacted by the opioid crisis are not being centered in how settlement dollars are being spent.
The compensation didn't go directly to the individuals hurt. It went to states, it went to counties, and it went to cities. And unfortunately, again, lessons learned from HIV, we learned that you cannot get money to communities unless community is at the table and has a not just a recommendation role, but has a role of power. So in HIV, we got money out through what was called community planning. And that meant that government and community was at the table. They had to agree, look at the data, not what you believe where the money should go, follow the data with the money, and then agree that that is the way the money is going to go out the door. And if there's not agreement, government doesn't get the money to put out the door.
And for funds that have gone out the door, some have criticized local counties for not using the funds to its full potential. For instance, all unrestricted dollars in 2024, roughly $37,000 in Sullivan County, went to law enforcement. Gardner also says that how funds are being distributed isn't happening equitably.
This is happening across the country, that we're seeing numbers diminishing in terms of overdose deaths. It's just not happening equally or uniformly, right?
While overdose deaths among white people have fallen, for Black, Latino, and Indigenous people, overdose death rates have skyrocketed nationwide.
Black people in rural settings are at particular risk for overdose deaths. And Black communities in what I call the suburban urbans, but basically the big cities outside of New York City are also, their Black communities are also not experiencing the same level of decline in deaths.
Black New Yorkers are less likely to have access to treatment care and life-saving measures like Narcan, and more likely to be criminalized for drug-related offenses. Gardner says anti-Black racism was embedded in fueling the opioid crisis from the beginning.
The anti-Blackness that's built in to these systems, I feel, informed even the beginning of the prescription pill crisis, because these doctors were saying to people, you won't get addicted like those people. You can take these pills. You're not going to get addicted. And that is in the heads of people, that they so associate Black and brown people with addiction, that that was easily embraced rather than the science of the addictive nature of opioids.
Gardner is also a board member for the state's Opioid Settlement Fund Advisory Board. But while she sits on the advisory board, she says she's limited on what she can do. That's because the advisory board can only recommend to OASIS how dollars are spent based on research and evidence.
We cannot force the agency that administers the dollars, Office of Addiction Support Services, we can't compel them. And so to me, it's because the lawyers who negotiated the settlements and agreed or made agreements with the manufacturers about how the money would go out. It was constructed like tobacco settlement versus constructed like community planning dollars.
That's increasingly becoming a problem as billions of dollars in federal funding for housing, healthcare, and other services disappear. In July, Opioid Advisory Board members and OASIS clashed over how to respond to a looming threat. Would New York use opioid settlement money to make up for federal aid? instead of its intended purpose. Advisory board members urged Oasis to cut the red tape and get the money out quickly. Rob Ken agrees.
And I'm afraid that states will look to steal, because that's what I'm just going to call it. It's a flat out steal, opioid settlement funds to cover losses that have nothing to do with opioid abatement.
So what states are doing it well? Coming up, we're heading south, all the way down from the Catskills to North Carolina. We wanted to talk to other states to learn how they've managed their opioid settlement funds. North Carolina has been touted as a model for making it as transparent as possible to see where money flows. So, how'd they do it? That's right after this break.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Radio Catskill depends on donations from our listeners, including donations from our listeners' music collections. People donate their music collections to us, we sell them to the next generation of music fans, and that keeps the station on air. Records, CDs, stereo equipment, and more. It comes from the community and goes back to the community, so Radio Catskill can stay on the air for the community. Donate your music collection today. Email feedback at wjffradio.org.
I'm Jason Dolp. It's the Local Edition, and we're listening to Health on the Margins, a special look at local healthcare issues with Kimberly Izar. And let's go back to Kimberly now.
We're back with Health on the Margins. I'm Kimberly Izar. We've been looking at the barriers New York State has to get opioid settlement dollars out the door. And we're about to head to North Carolina, which has been touted as a model for making it as easy as possible to know where opioid settlement funds are going. North Carolina is expected to receive $750 million over the next 18 years in opioid settlement dollars. That's less than a quarter of what New York State has secured so far. But there's a big difference between the two states. For North Carolina, you can go to the state's opioid settlement tracker and see how each local government is spending the money. You can't do that for New York.
There's 100 counties in North Carolina, and we all have individual challenges, but a lot of our challenges are the same. And so, you know, if I'm feeling a little stuck in a certain area or not really sure, I can pull up the CORNC website and go to another county and see how they've decided to spend their funds. You know, maybe a county of a similar size or similar, demographic. And I can see what's happening in Alamance County. I can see what's happening in Wake County. I can see what's happening in Edgecombe County. So, I mean, it just feels like statewide, there's a true collaboration and partnership.
That's Tia Fowler. She's the assistant county manager and opioid settlement manager for Nash County in North Carolina. Like Sullivan County in New York, Nash County in North Carolina is a smaller rural area of the state. Both counties have a similar population size, with both counties having about 80 to 100,000 residents. And both say substance use stigma still remains a big hurdle to seeking treatment.
Stigma is a huge barrier to treatment. In a small community, people care what other people think. You know what I mean? Everyone kind of knows everyone. And so overcoming stigma is a big thing in smaller communities. In all communities, but definitely in smaller communities where everybody really knows their neighbor.
Fella says Nash County did something different when planning for the future. They asked communities directly how to use the money before any money was even allocated. They hosted community town halls at five locations to hear directly from people most affected by the opioid crisis.
The strategies that we have started with are a direct response to the feedback from our community, but also aligns with the options available in our memorandum of agreement. And so after compiling all of this information, we were able to get some just really consistent feedback from our community members. There's definitely a need for treatment. There are not a lot of treatment providers in our community. There's definitely a need for early intervention. One of the more passionate parts of our community conversation is when community members are talking about how early children are exposed and using drugs in our school systems. And this isn't unique to Nash County. This is really nationwide.
She says that extra step involving the community resulted in subtle yet big ways for how dollars are distributed. For example, both Nash County in North Carolina and Sullivan County in New York have some form of an emergency overdose response team. But Sullivan County's money goes to the local police department, and Nash County's money goes to community ambulance providers. Of course, each community and state are different, but it poses a larger question of, are these dollars being dictated by what the community says they need?
What's making them be received so well is that people are feeling that their local government cares, right? There's like feeling behind it. They can feel that we're listening. They can feel that we care. And in a time where I think people are often frustrated with their local government, this gives an opportunity for them to really see their wishes, their needs in action. And that's something that I'm really excited about.
Fowla says that she's hopeful that other states like New York can learn from North Carolina's approach to transparency and community planning. While Nash County is still in its early stages of implementation, she's hopeful that the state's collaborative nature will benefit communities most affected by the opioid crisis.
It feels like just an overall effort to make sure that the communities are better off than when we started. And so I feel like I have a lot of support from our community. I feel like I have a lot of support from our commissioners. It just really feels like we're not in this alone. It can feel overwhelming to try to solve, you know, an opioid crisis in your community. You know, sometimes you need to talk to some partners to help to resolve issues. But I really do feel like we have the resources and the partnership for all local governments in North Carolina to be successful.
Next time on Health on the Margins, we look at women's and reproductive health care in the region. In 2020, the only Planned Parenthood in Sullivan County closed. The next nearest Planned Parenthood clinic in Goshen closed 4 years later, along with three other upstate locations. So where do people go for reproductive health care services in our region? That's next time on Health on the Margins. If you or someone you know needs help, you can find treatment and support at findtreatment.gov. You can also call the 988 Lifeline at 988 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if you need someone to talk to. Health on the Margins is hosted, reported, and produced by me, Kimberly Izar, with contributed reporting by Julia Kim and Patricio Rabayo. Editorial support by Tim Bruno, Jason Dole, Ronald Kelson, Patricio Rabayo, and Genevieve Hardnett. The music in this episode is from Lexin_music from Pixabay. If you enjoyed the show, let us know by leaving us a comment wherever you get your podcasts.
Big thanks to Kimberly Izar for reporting. Health on the Margins is up now at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes debut the first Wednesday of the month. Listen online, WJFFradio.org. And that is it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Retro Cocktails coming up at 7, Retro Cocktail Hour, followed by Virtual Soundscapes at 9. Right now, we've got more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
If this court, which has in recent months greenlit lots of Trump programs on an emergency basis, if it stands up to President Trump now, that will be a much more assertive image for the Supreme Court and the beginning of probably a real clash between the president and the court.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois on the immigration raids taking place throughout Chicago and well beyond.
He's creating mayhem on the ground because you know what he wants? He wants troops on the ground in American cities. And the only way he can get that done is by proving that there's some sort of insurrection taking place on the streets of Chicago.
J.B. Pritzker, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker